Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Al Wyman was a well-known reporter for years on KSDK and KMOV here in St. Louis. But before he arrived in the Midwest, Wyman was a radio and TV reporter in Los Angeles. He became best known for his reporting on the Charles Manson murders. He even found a key piece of evidence connected with the murder of Sharon Tate. Today on Profiles, reporter Al Wyman.
Welcome to Profiles. From entertainers to athletes, political leaders to entrepreneurs, Profiles gives you an insight into what has made these unique personalities who and what they are today. Now, Profiles on St. Louis's News Radio, KMOX.
Al Wyman, my guest on KMOX Profiles. Al, how are you?
Just great. Thanks for having me.
Oh, thank you so much for coming in. You know, we reconnected during the 50th anniversary of the the Tate LaBianca murders, and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood had come out, and we had a great interview in 2019. I thought, you know what, this would make a really good KMOX profile, not only because of your connection back then in Los Angeles with the Charles Manson case and Helter Skelter and all that, but also some of the other things that you've done throughout your career. So this will be a fun conversation with us here on KMOX.
Fire away.
You let's go. I tend to do this with some of my profiles. I like to do a This Is Your Life and find out a little bit, because I don't know what happened before you were in L.A. in the 1960s. So where are you from originally?
From Mississippi.
Okay.
Born in Jackson, Mississippi, and got my radio start when I was in high school at the local radio station, WLAU.
Isn't that awesome? So I started here when I was in high school as well. So you got bit by the bug very early.
Very early. We had had a student exchange program between students in the high school at Laurel, Mississippi, and students at the high school in Wausau, Wisconsin. And during the exchange, I was one of the people picked to go on the exchange. I met and heard a guy in high school on the radio, and I said, "How did you do that?" He said, "Well, I went down to the radio station and said, I want a job."
Yeah, right. And the rest is history, right?
Well, they gave me a tape recorder at the mm-hmm. local station in Laurel, and they said, "Why don't you go home and read some articles out of the newspaper and bring that back, and we'll listen to the tape together." And it was awful.
Yeah, well, believe me, I somewhere in the deep recesses of my basement, I cleaned out a bunch of stuff, but you'd find some. I did find some cassettes from back in the day when I was on the 10-watt powerhouse KYMC here in St. Louis that was run by the YMCA. You know, I've shared this story several times. There were a bunch of us who worked there, student-run, supervised by the YMCA, but you had to pay to work there because it was a YMCA program. So you paid like $15 a month, or when I say you, my parents paid $15 a month for me to work there. But, you know, we ended up being mentored by somebody that KMOX listeners would know very well, and that's Bob Hamilton, the legendary Hamilton. He used to listen to my air checks, and he was the guy who said, "Yeah, that's not very good," but he would coach me at the time, which was great. So you start in radio, then do you go to university, as they say?
I went all over the place. I went to Mississippi State University.
Yeah.
And did some work part-time at a radio station in Columbus, Mississippi, which is the home of MSCW, Mississippi State College for Women, at the time. And then I went to LSU, and I was on the student radio station there. And then I went to NYU and was on that student radio station, and then gave that up when I got a job as an NBC page.
So
how
did you end up going to NYU? What was the plan there?
Well, I wanted to go to the big city. Yeah. I had never been there except when I went through New York on the way to a summer job during college as a camp counselor in the Catskills at a camp run by the New York Protestant Episcopal Mission Society. And we had indigent kids that came for camp terms of 2 weeks all summer long. And it was during that that episode of going to New York for the first time, I happened to have grown up in the same hometown as Leontine Price. And the woman who gave her her career and sent her to Juilliard picked out some students in Laurel, Mississippi, and I happened to be lucky enough to be one of them. And she said, what do you want to do? And I said, well, I want to go to New York. And she said, you've never been there before. So she bought me a train ticket at the time.
What year was this?
This was in the 50s.
Okay.
And went to New York, and the first time I'd ever been there. And she said, and here's the name of my ticket agent, and I want you to go, and I want you to go to as many Broadway shows as you can go. And I went to see Major Barbara with Charles Laughton and Cat on a Hot Tin Roof with Ben Cazzara. And then went, took a bus up to Parksville, New York, where the camp was located. And anyway, I just really had a thirst for the big city.
And it's funny that you were an NBC page. There are stories out there. I'm trying to think of a couple names that come to mind of people that did start as NBC pages, right?
I know. I worked with some of them. One of the guys I worked with wound up being a producer of one of those old NBC shows where they did biographies on different movie stars.
Oh, yeah.
And he and his wife was a guidette, as they called him at the time, and I was a page. I was a guide first, and then I got into the page and worked all the shows. We were given an allowance, if you want to call it that. We had to stand inspection with our white collared button.
Oh yeah, who was doing the inspecting?
The guy who ran the uniform office, or the I think his name was Mr. Walsh, and we'd have to stand inspection, spit shine your shoes, stand inspection, and then stand by because every time anybody bought a ticket for a tour, they would call upstairs and send one of us down.
I'm doing. You may have heard some typing there because Wikipedia is wonderful. Let's see, notable. We'll see if you're featured. Notable NBC pages. Chuck Barris was an NBC page from The Gone Show. Dave Garraway from The Today Show. Actress Kate Jackson. Ted Koppel. Regis Philbin. Aubrey Plaza, who is an actress. Eva Marie St. Willard Scott. Ephraim Zemblis Jr., and Al Wyman, notable NBC pages. But, I knew that there were, and there are some more names, because every once in a while I'll read an interview from a director or somebody, that's involved with today, with Hollywood, and they talk about how they started as an NBC page.
Well, do you remember during the Charles Van Doren era, the quiz show?
Yes.
One of our pages said in the locker room, where we would all sit around and chat before we had to go on duty, said that he heard audible prompting. And we said, what? The $64,000 question, this guy's a genius. And he said he heard audible prompting to the guy, Van Doren,
yes,
that was supposed to have been in the soundproof booth.
That's interesting. Yeah, that's a good movie quiz show.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Sure.
So then is that basically, that's how you get your start in television now, right?
Well, no.
Sort of?
I finally did as much as I could do, and then I decided I had gone about as far as you could go. I was on the page staff, worked the Tonight Show. That was Jack Parr at the time. The Steve Allen Show every Sunday night. All these great shows. Perry Como was every Saturday at the Ziegfeld Theater. They give us 35 cents, and what we would do is pool our money and hire a cab
to take us
from Rockefeller Center to the different theaters.
So that was your per diem, 35 cents?
35, travel per diem.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, I think the pay was really enormous, $49 a week in the 50s. So it was enough for two meals a day, one of which always had to be a hamburger. Anyway, I went from there, decided to go back to Mississippi, and got a job at a radio station in Jackson, Mississippi, and simultaneously got a job at WLBT Television doing a Teen Tempo's dance party show every Saturday, along with two other folks who were of similar ages. We were all in our early 20s, and was really happy and riding along until the draft notice came. And I decided, wisely or unwisely, to join the Navy. I wanted to have a warm bunk to sleep in instead of a foxhole.
St. Louis's traffic station, KMOX. Now back to Profiles on St. Louis's News Radio, KMOX.
Reporter Al Wyman, my guest on KMOX Profiles. You might remember him from his days here at Channel 4 and Channel 5. He worked in Los Angeles in the 1960s, became a part of the Charles Manson case, and we're going to get to that as we get through this KMOX Profile. So before the break, you talked about the draft. So did you head to Vietnam?
No, I joined.
Or was this Korea?
This was, I was there from 59 to 62, 4 years, really. And I, in classification, I took materials with me to prove that I had worked in radio and TV, and I was sent in classification at boot camp to be interviewed by a lieutenant commander, and he said, "Oh, we've been looking for people like you with broadcast experience.
Someone with communications experience, yeah.
We have Armed Forces Radio and Television Service. We have facilities in Los Angeles and in New York. Which one would you like to go to?" And I said, "Oh, New York." And they sent me exactly the opposite to Los Angeles.
Oh, did they? Wow. So that's the connection out west.
So I was there for 2 years. And while I was there, there was an Army private there, Gene Weed, who worked part-time consecutively at KFWB while he was in the Army. And he introduced me to Chuck Bloor, the program director. And my first job at KFWB, which was the number one station there at the time, with jingles by Pam and Dallas, you know, KFWB, Channel 98, anybody that lived in that era.
Well, and that was, you know, I think we talked about this when Once Upon a Time in Hollywood came out, but Quentin Tarantino uses those jingles from that era very effectively.
Yeah, and I had not seen the movie when we talked before, but I did see it, and that they really did shoot at, I guess, what is now left of the Spahn Ranch. Right?
Yeah.
It looked exactly like that.
He recreated it. It was amazing. We'll get to all the Manson stuff here,
though. Anyway, I spent 2 years at Armed Forces Radio and Television Service, and was literally shanghaied out of the place by jealous people. They got me assigned to go to sea duty. In Navy, you do 2 years shore, 2 years sea duty, and they had me transferred, unbeknownst to me, to a guided missile cruiser, the USS Topeka, in the Pacific Fleet.
What was the jealousy about?
Because I was, this young kid from Mississippi, a Navy seaman, didn't even have any rank to speak of. And he's got a job at the number one TV, number one radio station. And here we are, you know, there were jealous people in civil service. And they made sure that I was sought after by the Navy to go to. A chaplain came through one day at Armed Forces Radio, and he said, "I want to start a radio station on our ship."
Yeah.
And they said, "We have the perfect guy for you, Al Wyman. He's been here for about 2 years. Oh, you should take him." And they did. As a consequence, I had, I believe, the only ship in the Pacific Fleet that had jingles, because I wrote to KTOP Topeka and got them to send me a set of the jingles.
Did you really?
Yes.
I love it.
It was.
But you got to do it right?
Yeah. And then I ran the radio station and did traffic reports on the starboard chow line and the port chow line, and I got head of line privileges, and I never liked the food, so I stocked my office that I had in the journalism section of the with boxes of cereal, you know, those little tiny open-up boxes. So if I didn't like what they served, I ate cereal.
What kind of cereal, Al? Do you remember?
Kellogg's.
Yeah, Kellogg's, like Corn Puffs or something, like Corn Flakes. Right. They were around. Well, I love hearing little nuggets like that. But, you know, that all is painting the picture of how you had this success and really were in some amazing encounters throughout your career. I'm going to fast forward just a little bit here because I want to make sure that we talk enough about the connection with Charles Manson. But before we get to that, you end up, how do you end up in L.A. then?
Because that's Hollywood, Armed Forces Radio and TV, and I worked at KFWB. And when I was discharged from the Navy in San Diego, I flew up to L.A. At that time, you could fly between San Diego and Los Angeles for $6.
Yeah.
And I walked in and I said, well, I'm a civilian now. And they said, well, beginning Monday, we've got problems with the FCC, and we need a public affairs director. And how about doing that? And then you can do some air work on the weekends.
You were in the right place at the right time sometimes.
There you go.
All right, so I'm going to get you here to 1964.
I don't know if this sound has to be explained. This is the sound of Beatlemania in the Hollywood Bowl. This is Al Wyman, and I'm standing on the stage of the Hollywood Bowl with a din of shouts going in the background. The Beatles are now on stage and beginning their performance. Listen to the crowd. The Beatles start their performance. The roar increases. I'm looking into the audience. Flash bulbs are going off in every direction. The audience jumping up and down in several areas. This is something like I've never seen before.
That is just amazing, Al Wyman. So can you flash back to that concert and those screaming girls?
Yeah. First of all, when they first arrived in Los Angeles for the concert, they had a news conference at L.A. Airport, and it was below the Pan Am Terminal. And the news conference turned into such bedlam that I just said, to hell with it. And I just climbed over everybody with my microphone, and somebody from Channel 11 said, here, hold my mic. And I nuzzled up next to Paul McCartney to try to ask him a few questions.
How'd that go for you?
As I can remember, he was nice, and, you know, I asked a couple of questions. Mostly everybody was shouting for me to sit down when I was climbing up there. But if you didn't climb up there and get next to them, you'd never get anything on tape.
But
so that's what I did.
This was them also discovering what they ended up seeing the rest of their lives, right?
Yeah, this was really bedlam. I was worked at KFWB as I worked as public affairs director, and I eventually got the title of news director and assistant program director because there were so many drunks there.
Hey, you get it, whatever you take it, how they come, right?
You know, Mark.
Exactly. Yes, I do.
I accumulated titles. But anyway, I decided to go to the concert with my KFWB tape recorder, the Stencil Hoffman. You know those, the little tiny
ones. Right, right.
That did 7.5 IPS. I went and I flashed. I took the KFWB sign off the tape recorder and I just walked. I had a concert ticket that got me in the gate. Then I flashed my press pass and walked right backstage and walked to the edge of the Hollywood Bowl stage. And that's where I stayed during the concert and made that tape. And afterwards, tried to do some interviews with people, and it was even bedlam afterwards.
Well, we'll go out with this, and we'll come back. We're going to talk about the Manson stuff when we come back on this KMOX Profile with Al Wyman.
I don't know if you're able to distinguish any of the sounds other than the shouting, but the Beatles are performing on stage at this very moment in the Hollywood Bowl.
News Radio 1120 KMOX, the voice of the Cardinals. Now back to Profiles on St. Louis's News Radio KMOX.
Welcome back to KMOX Profiles. Reporter Al Wyman is with me. We've gone over the early part of his career. He ended up here in St. Louis. What year did you come to St. Louis, Al?
It was, I think, 72.
And you were on the air in St. Louis from what year? From 72 to what year?
Well, about 40 years worth.
Yeah, a long time at a couple of different stations, right?
Yeah.
Channel 4 and Channel 5.
Channel 4
and
Channel 5.
Ended up being at the Science Center as well, but I want to talk about 1969 because this is a fascinating story. We mentioned earlier the not only the anniversary, but the movie, Quentin Tarantino's movie Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, which ended up being my number one movie of 2019. And, you know, the more I thought about that movie, the more I was impressed by it. But how is Al Wyman connected to Charles Manson and that whole story, that tragedy from 50 years ago?
It was a Saturday morning in July. I think it was July 29th. And I was every other weekend or every couple of weeks, you got Saturday duty, and I was on Saturday duty. And we got a call from the assignment desk over the radio to go to an address in Beverly Hills on Cielo Drive. There had been a murder reported. And so we got up the, you know, the Thomas Brothers map books. You didn't have Google search at
yes,
that time.
Right.
Found the address, went to the address, and it was a weird place because you went off Benedict Canyon up a drive, Cielo Drive, and it dead-ended. And at the dead end, there was a fence that you could see through, you know, and beyond the fence was a car, and there was a body in the car. And the fence was locked, and there were LAPD people there. There was a reporter from City News Service that was there first, let's be fair. But we were the first radio or TV people that showed up. And I said, what's going on here? And the City News person said, I really don't know. The cops won't tell us anything, but there's been a murder here. So slowly in Los Angeles, more and more crews began to show up, radio reporters, television stations, other. I was with Channel 7, KABC. And finally, after we were there for about an hour or more, Rona Barrett showed up. Rona Barrett did gossip on Channel 7 as well as ABC Network at the time. And I went up and said, Miss Rona, we always called her Miss Rona, what's going on? Why are you here at the scene of a murder? She said, don't you know who lives here? And I said, I have no idea. This is Roman Polanski's house. Sharon Tate is living here. Jay Sebring hangs out here. And a lot of other Hollywood, you know, wannabes and actual stars.
Put that, before we move on, put that into perspective just a little bit. Because Roman Polanski at that time and Sharon Tate was becoming a big star, right?
Yes. Yeah.
He had done, what had he done up until that point? Had he done Rosemary's Baby?
Yeah.
Okay.
And so, I mean, that was, I guess, probably the number one scariest movie anyone had ever seen. And Sharon Tate was just becoming a big star with a couple of roles she had had. And this was, you know, they were a famous Hollywood couple, but there were a lot of people hung out at that place. And what I found out later is that at one time, Terry Melcher had rented this house. He's Doris Day's son, and he was a record producer. And Manson was taken up there to that house one day and auditioned, if you speak, so to speak, with his music. He played some tapes of some of his songs. And Terry Melcher didn't see a star there or didn't see a breakthrough and dismissed him. I mean, said, you know, I'm sorry, this won't work. Manson never got over that. And so here it was, all these people inside that house that night were slaughtered by members of the Manson family. Charlie sent them specifically to that address. He didn't know who lived there at the time. He just remembered he had been there, but he sent them with instructions, you know, kill everybody up there. And they did. And more and more people showed up, and then I called the assignment desk and said, you better get a helicopter to get aerial shots because we're not going to get anything from the cops for a long time.
So when did the LaBianca murders take place then?
The very next night.
Okay, so that was the next night. So
right.
At this point, you're trying, look, Sharon Tate, these other people have been murdered. How did this happen? It's horrific, right?
Right. I didn't cover the LaBianca. There was another reporter at Channel 7, Bob Banfield, covered that. But with the similarities, all of us in the news media that said they have to be connected. And the LAPD said, oh, no, there's no connection to this. And Then I had a very good friend who had good connections with the Sheriff's Department and their intelligence division, and he told me that this was also the killings of these two cases were similar to the killing of a musician in Topanga Canyon by the name of Gary Hinman, that he had been slaughtered and pig was written on in blood on the wall of his apartment or his house in Topanga Canyon. So it looked like, wait a minute,
yeah,
these have to be connected. And we actually didn't break the Manson story itself. Channel 2 did. They had a reporter that actually broke the story about the Manson family. I had heard that there were a bunch of hippies running around in Baker, up in the mountains at the Barker Ranch at Bishop, California, I'm sorry, and thought, well, what in the world? And anyway, this Channel 2 broke the story about what happened. You know, I'm getting way ahead, but
you mean the Manson connection,
yeah,
to that? Yeah.
And then Charlie was arrested up in Bishop, California, and we flew up there in a helicopter. We met a highway patrolman, and he said, if you guys are going to the Barker Ranch, you better be careful. There are some hippies running around in cut-down Volkswagens that had made them into dune buggies. And he said, and they're armed and dangerous, and they're liable to kill you if they find you up there. And so we got directions from the helicopter pilot of the CHP, and we flew there. And we were photographing an old school bus that had clothes, and we photographed the house where they arrested him, and supposedly they arrested him underneath the sink in the house, in the ranch house, and we were filming that. And the helicopter pilot came running and screaming, saying, there's somebody coming, there's somebody coming. Jet Rangers take a little time to warm up before you get the rotor going. And I said, well, you crazy fool. What are you doing running down? Why weren't you starting the helicopter?
Right.
And he said, oh. And he ran back to start it. And we kept hearing somebody coming. I said, well, we're going to buy the farm here because you're never going to get that started. We're not going to get out of here. And it turned out to be a Life magazine photographer that had hired a four-wheel drive vehicle to drive him up there to the ranch. So we escaped that.
So that was, let's get the time
frame
in here.
That was in the fall.
Okay, that was in the fall.
Yes.
But then, so we know, the police know that there's this Charles Manson guy, and at that point, do they make connections to a cult, or they don't know a lot about him at that point?
They don't know a lot about him, but Susan Atkins had decided that she was going to be a prosecution witness, and she took them to the house and walked through the steps of how the victims, Sharon Tate and the rest of them, were killed, and said that when they finished, they went back to where they were living. We didn't know that at the time, that they were at the Spawn Ranch. And we changed clothes, and we washed off and changed clothes. And then we just threw the clothes out. And there was a picture of Boy Scouts in the Monday morning Los Angeles Times.
Yeah, so it's important, though, to keep in mind. So the murder takes place in August or July?
July.
July. So now we're in December,
yes,
and the story starts to unfold, and there's clothes that have been thrown out, but 5 months later, those clothes have not been discovered.
No. And Susan Atkins told them we just threw them out, and they sent Boy Scouts out.
I was telling somebody recently this story, and they're like, they sent Boy Scouts out to look,
yes,
for blood? I'm like, yes, they did, right?
Because the PR director at the police department, Dan Cook, Sergeant Dan Cook, was a big Boy Scout person. So what better thing? Oh, I'll get all these volunteer scouts, and we'll go comb the hillsides instead of a bunch of cops. They had Boy Scouts looking for the clothes, and they didn't find them.
So the way that they found those clothes, the way that you found those clothes, we'll tell that story in a moment on KMOX Profiles.
The pitch.
KMOX is the exclusive Cardinals station.
Swing and another
one. When the Cards take a break, we're talking baseball on the Munganess St. Louis Honda Sports Open Line. Weeknights at 6:15 on the Voice of the Cardinals. Now back to Profiles on St. Louis's News Radio, KMOX.
Reporter Al Wyman, my guest on KMOX Profiles, and we're going to go back to December of 1969, And this was your report on KABC.
Taking into account the published report in the Los Angeles Times, the story that Susan Atkins told about what allegedly happened that night after the murder at the Tate House, we drove from Cielo Drive at the base of Benedict Canyon up here across from 2901 Benedict Canyon. Leaving from Cielo Drive, driving up Benedict Canyon, we timed ourselves and tried to place ourselves in the same position that the people would have been in that night after they left the Tate House. 6 minutes and 20 seconds of moderate driving up Benedict Canyon led us to this spot. And looking over the edge of this hill, we found several pairs of blue jeans and what appeared to be some very dark sweatshirts. These shirts and the blue jeans appear to have stains on them. So without hesitation, I went directly across the street to 2901 Benedict Canyon, used the telephone, called Lieutenant Robert Helder, LAPD Homicide, and told him that I think we have found the clothes they're looking for.
Okay, there's like lots of stuff that's crazy about that. First of all, that there's clothes that's there 5 months later.
Yes.
Second, that you do this experiment as a reporter. You're like, okay, let's see if we change clothes. Which clothes did you change into?
The clothes I had
okay.
on. But here's the weirdest part. That very morning, we were sent by the assignment desk, let's go back to and see what their cops are doing. No one was there. No one was searching. And we were stopped at a wide place on the road in Benedict Canyon. And we got a call on the radio, go down to Parker Center. There was a news conference. And I looked over the edge and I actually saw the clothes. But I didn't know what they were at the time.
Oh, really?
And I said, wouldn't that be crazy if those were the clothes? Then we went to the news conference. But in the afternoon, we went back to the house, and I literally got in the back seat, and I undressed all the way down to my skivvies and redressed. And it took me 6 minutes and 20 seconds. And when we stopped the car, I jumped out and said, my God, those are the clothes. They have to be. Where else would you, or what else would you? People don't throw clothes over the edge of a car.
I don't think I remember that part of the story.
I have that in my notebooks that I gave to the documentary people. They are photographing those. They're doing a documentary about Manson that's going to be on multi-part in February.
Yeah, you had last time you came in, you had all those notebooks, so they have those right now.
Yeah,
I think it's fascinating. So listen, this is another thing that's great. So you find the clothes. Hey, let's let the police know that, right?
It's right down there. There are several pairs of blue jeans, and there are some black T-shirts. And they appear to have bloodstains on them, and there's also a white T-shirt down there that appears to have bloodstains on it. We found it here about 3:30.
We'll go down and take a look at it.
Yeah.
Been down yet?
Yeah, we've been down. That's why it's dug up. There were no tracks or anything until we went down the hill to look at it.
Al, they weren't exactly thrilled, were they?
Oh, no. But the weirdest thing is if you look at the film of that, which is, I guess, on the internet, they picked up those clothes with their bare hands. They weren't wearing rubber gloves. In this day and age, my God, you'd have, contamination suits on. You'd be wearing booties and headgear and rubber gloves.
Well, and
they
because
picked them up with their bare hands and put them in,
well,
in
it was
bags.
Way, way ahead of DNA testing, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Here's what it sounded like when they found stuff.
Well, we found some trousers and some shirts, appeared to be turtleneck shirts or something, dark in color.
Did they appear to have any stains on them, or are you permitted to make that determination in the field?
No observation as far as stains.
How many of each garments?
I didn't count them. I would say two or three sets.
So, Al, how important you are featured in the book Helter Skelter,
yes,
by Vincent Bugliosi. There's a picture of you in there. I can't remember. Were you featured? The story was recounted in the movie version as well, right?
No.
Not as much?
No.
Okay.
No.
I couldn't remember if they covered it in the movie.
No, I don't think they didn't mention that at all. No one ever talked to me about that. But the people that made An Inconvenient Truth and Waiting for Superman, the documentary people, flew me to California and interviewed me, and they're doing a whole documentary. The documentary is not just about the murders. It's about Manson. It's going to be on in February. And I don't know the channel right now, but it's going to be a multi-part probably starting on a Sunday night or a Monday night and running all week long.
Well, something tells me that we try to time these profile airings out around significant events. So we'll probably, I bet there are people listening right now that are aware of that. By the way, I don't know if, is it Davis Guggenheim who's doing the movie?
It's the same people that work with Guggenheim.
So he's from here, obviously. Yeah. His father did that great Arch documentary. He was the director of Waiting for Superman, which is a fantastic movie. So at this, and this almost begs a second profile, Al. It really does, because I feel like we're shortchanging the rest of the story. But after the discovery of the bloody clothing, does that accelerate the process then of prosecution?
Yes, it moved along. It was something that really that solidified the story of Susan Atkins. She eventually went, they called her, the rest of the Manson family girls called her Sadie Glutz when she went prosecution. Then she flipped back and went to a Charlie follower.
She's still in prison today, isn't she?
No, she died.
Oh, she did die.
Yes,
a few years ago. It was recent, wasn't it?
Yeah, not too long ago.
Yeah, sometimes I forget the time frame.
But one of them is still trying to get parole, and I don't know if they'll give it to her. She says she's changed, but I wonder if the people who were on the parole board ever looked at the photographs of the murder scene.
Well, you would hope so.
Because one of the defense attorneys, Ira Reiner, who eventually became the district attorney there, when he defended one of the family members, he saw the pictures at at the county courthouse, and he got so sick he had to go to the restroom and throw up.
Can't even imagine.
I mean, it was pretty horrible. And we still talk about Manson today.
Yeah,
he's gone.
Al Wyman. Great conversation in 90 seconds, because I didn't get to this. Can you tell your Elvis story?
Well, I was introduced by Danny Thomas, and someday I'll play the tape for you. We were doing the Teen March Against Leukemia at KFWB, which started raising the money that eventually went to Bill St. Jude's Research Hospital in Memphis.
Wow, isn't that crazy? That's still a big thing today, right?
And Elvis gave the presidential yacht to Danny Thomas so they could sell the yacht and use that money to help get the funds necessary to build St. Jude's. And Danny Thomas, I was in public affairs director, and we ran the teen march, and where teens went on a Sunday to collect, and those that collected the most money, we had a Hollywood Bowl concert for them on a Saturday morning, and Danny was very appreciative of that. And at the news conference where Elvis, Danny introduced me to Elvis, and I've never met such a shy person in my life.
I had heard about it, especially that point in his career.
Yeah,
Al Wyman,
but he was nice,
very
nice guy.
You got the Beatles, Elvis, Charlie Manson, so many stories from your time in Los Angeles and Mississippi and here in St. Louis. Great to have you in for KMOX Profiles.
Thank you, Mark.
You've been listening to Profiles. If you missed any of this episode or want to hear other profiles, go to KMOX.com and click on demand.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.